Welcome to the NASDAQ Entrepreneurial Centers podcast. In this recording, join Nathan Beckert, CEO of Foundersuite, Falon Fatemi, founder of Node, Sam Lesson, partner at Slow Ventures, Johnny Reich, CEO at Quill, and Ben Curran, CEO of Greenbits, for a discussion on Startup Funding 2.0, How I Raised It. Here they are.
So my name's Nathan. I run Foundersuite. If you're not familiar, it's a set of CRM tools for raising money, investor database, investor CRM. So check it out. It's pretty helpful. We launched about 2 years ago, and our customers have raised $750 million in seed and VC. So it's working for a lot of startups. So tonight, here's how the format's going to work. I'm going to have Falon come on first. I'm going to interview her. She's raised money recently, and then she's actually got to get out for a dinner date, but then our next speaker will come on. And then we're going to do this kind of like late night talk show host format where I'll be interviewing these guys. And then they'll stay up here and then it'll turn into kind of a panel. And I wanted to make it open at that point. So can we welcome our first guest, Falon of Node. All right. How you doing?
Good. How are you?
Thanks so much for coming here. What is Node? Just tell us like, what is Node? How'd you come up with the idea for this business? What are you all about?
All right. So Node is an AI-powered discovery engine that identifies the relevant people and companies that you should partner with, sell to, market to, perhaps even raise funding from. And the story behind Node really has to do... So I was the youngest employee at Google. I was there for 6 years. I spent 6 years in the startup world as well. And the story behind the company actually had to do with a lot of the work I did in the startup world, where I was making a lot of introductions between people and companies and resources, and decided to do an analysis of all the introductions that I made and uncovered that a lot of the intros I made actually resulted in life-changing opportunities for both individuals and businesses. So I found out my introductions had led to millions of dollars in investment, a number of acquisitions, a number of sales and marketing partnerships, hires, even a merger. And so that was the sort of aha moment where I realized there was some sort of matchmaking algorithm that I had uncovered, and I basically set out to try to productize that. And that's really sort of the story behind the company.
So when did you start this? How long have you been banging away at Node?
Oh, I've been in the trenches for 3.5 years.
Did you leave Google to start this, or was there something in between?
So I was at Google for 6 years, was in the startup world for 6 years, and then started Node. So
this topic is about fundraising. How did you finance this? How did you build this? How did you fund this in the early days? I think it's always interesting to hear kind of like prior to all these exciting rounds that we're going to talk about. How did you get this thing off the ground?
So the real story. So I'm a single founder. I mean, as a solo founder, I was blessed with a good network. But outside of that, my first checks were actually from people that really did invest in me or encourage me to start the company. So one of those people was Mark Cuban. He wrote one of my first checks. Another one was Lee Linden, who is an entrepreneur himself, was at Facebook most recently. And he really convinced me to start the company. So, I mean, in the early days, it was really... A lot of my mentors actually ended up backing me and saying, you know, I'm writing a check in you. Like, I'm writing a check to Falon and what you can create. And then from there, it was really all about just founder market fit and really telling the story about why I am the right person to solve this problem and really demonstrating my vision around it. And, you know, because I didn't build the initial product, I worked with an engineer to build it, really sort of communicating the vision in a visual fashion and then talking about the traction from an MVP approach to kind of demonstrate the potential of what I could execute on.
Let's go into your pitch for those sure. early days. You know, you had been this kind of consummate connector, networker, right? You opened with that. It was pretty interesting. Was your pitch basically like, I'm going to turn this into AI version of myself, or was it totally something else? Like,
no.
What were you pitching in those early days?
The vision has stayed the same. I mean, our vision as a company has been to connect people with opportunity at massive scale. Now, the way to get there and the actual product sort of form of that has shifted. But funny enough, it's actually still landing where I started. It's just now, I basically have the battle in the startup world is surviving long enough to find the people that can really make your technical vision, especially our moonshot vision, a reality. And that's exactly the case with us. I mean, this year we brought on board the founder and CTO, the guy who built the original search engine, AltaVista. He's our chief scientist. And our CTO invented electronic mobile boarding pass system that airlines use today. So, you know, we hired kind of two of the pillars of the deep learning space. And that's sort of 3.5 years into the company we got there.
I like that kind of advice of stay around, stay alive long enough.
Survival is 90% of it. Yeah.
No, I always say at Founders Street, we have cockroach DNA. Like, you just can't kill us. We've almost run out of money a few times, but we're still here and we're going to be here. Awesome. So I want to talk about Mark Cuban. I have him circled on my list here. How did you raise money from Mark Cuban? Tell us the story behind that. How'd you get in touch with him? How'd you get to know him?
Yeah. So I met Mark Cuban 6 years ago at a party at South by Southwest, of all places. And I was introduced through a mutual friend, and I didn't know who he was when I first met him. 6 years ago, he wasn't as famous as he is now. I mean, Shark Tank was still relatively new. And I thought I was having a really interesting conversation, pretty technical conversation with a really smart guy. And from that, we just kind of kept in touch. So South by Southwest is an example of one of the many events where you can really sort of be open to serendipity and come across people that maybe you wouldn't normally come across, because it's sort of an intersection or a center point for a lot of different people from different industries. And we kept in touch, and then he asked me to do some diligence for some of the companies on the West Coast he was thinking about investing in, and I did, and saved him from not making money and actually helped him make money. So I ended up introducing him to Drew Houston from Dropbox, which then made him an advisor and allowed him to invest, and obviously Dropbox IPO'd this year.
Awesome.
Wow. So I made him money first, and then when I started my company, and I said, look, I'm going to make you, I'm going to build AI that's going to make more introductions to Drew Houstons of the world. He said, I'm in.
That's cool. That's a pretty amazing story. It's interesting that you made that intro, because I think he was a super early investor in Box, right? And then did Aaron Levy buy him back? Or there was some story like
that. There was a little bit of drama there. We don't need to get into it.
Yeah. And then he got into Dropbox, and that just went public.
Yeah.
Awesome.
But Mark does respond to every email he gets. Well, he definitely reads them.
He definitely reads them.
Yeah.
Does he have someone else responding for him, or is it actually him?
It's him. It's him.
That's interesting. Any tips for folks that are actually going to, I'm sure there's some portion of the audience that's going to like pitch or email him later.
So he's not actually a fan of Silicon Valley. He thinks that companies here are too expensive and overpriced. So I think what he really believes in and wants to back are entrepreneurs that are just have a lot of grit and have demonstrable traction. And, without raising a ton of money. Obviously, if the problem that you're solving requires a lot more capital up front, sort of a different story. But he is pretty technical and really interested. I mean, he's quoted saying the first trillionaire will be an AI entrepreneur. So, I mean, he's really into sort of cutting edge deep learning NLP stuff.
Cool. Not to get it too far down that path, but does he actually help out all those companies he funds on Shark Tank? Those guys are doing so many deals. Yeah.
Oh, he's got a whole team of people. Mark Cuban Companies is actually his company. And he's got a team of people. He'll support their bookkeeping and so on. And I would say, as Silicon Valley entrepreneur with amazing VC firms that, we have the privilege to work with, I mean, Mark's one of the most active, involved, and supportive investors. I mean, he's a great partner to have. I mean, we went on Bloomberg together. I mean, he's been an amazing supporter of the business, and he's available anytime for, advice or whatever.
That's awesome. How often do you ping him? Move on to another topic, I promise.
I would probably talk once a month or whenever we're in town or whatever.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
All right. Let's talk a little more. So then you raised, I guess this is part of the same seed round, 6.3 from NEA and Canaan. And
so we've raised $21 million to date. We're a post-Series A company. 5.5 of that was in a Series Seed, and then the rest of it was in a Series A.
Gotcha. Let's talk about that a little bit. I mean, did you... NEA and Canaan, these are huge firms, huge funds. Did you already know them? Did you have to network your way into? How'd you get in,
I didn't know any of them. Have you guys seen Silicon Valley, HBO Silicon Valley? Have you seen the fundraising season where they first try to go about the process just, as honest and high integrity people, like, hey, we're looking for money. Here's what we're doing. Like, invest. It's going to be awesome. And they don't get a term sheet. And then they approach it a little bit differently. I'm not going to go into how differently they approach it. But then they get a term sheet, and they get many term sheets. So there is a strategy and approach, I'll say, to fundraising that sometimes you just need to kind of get advice from other founders that are farther along than you are to sort of get the cheat codes. And I will say, to give you guys the non-PG version, I mean, to be honest with you, fundraising is super challenging if you've never done it before. And a lot of it, I mean, I'm fortunate to have done sort of business development and partnerships, and there's a little bit of sort of a salesman aspect there that's really important, because you not only have to sell your business, you have to sell yourself. And really, in the seed stage, it's all about you determining the value of the company and really the confidence that you're communicating, not just the big picture vision. Because half the time, you know, they have to be really passionate and interested in how the world's going to be a better place if you succeed and want to back that for the long term. But really, it comes down to what they feel when they leave the meeting. If they feel like you're a founder that, you know what, maybe you have this idea now, but it might evolve and you're going to stick with it, you're going to make it happen. When I go back and I talk to my investors from NAA, they say, Fallon, like, you're a survivor. Like, we back you any day. We know we give you a dollar, you're going to go get $10 on that. And I think it's really because of the way in which I told the story, but also just in not giving up and demonstrating that over long periods of time. The game sort of aspect of it, the strategy and approach aspect of it, it really is like running a sales process. And I don't know if you guys are familiar with the quote of, but time is the killer of all deals. It really is true with fundraising. I've never raised funding when I didn't put time pressure. So most founders think that they don't have leverage when they go into a meeting with an investor. That is not true. And I think there's kind of three aspects of it. So one is you have to make sure you understand your audience and whether it's even worth spending time with that audience. So what I do every time I'm introduced to an investor or an investor emails me is I ask a series of questions. I do my discovery. I won't get on the phone. I'm not going to waste anyone's time. I'm not going to take a meeting to take a meeting with an investor. I'm going to ask, have you invested in other companies like mine? Give me examples of whether you've invested in AI, deep learning, or next generation search companies. That's the first thing. I want to understand, even understand what I'm doing. Then the second piece is, well, help me understand, what's your engagement model with companies? How do you work with companies that are staged? Do you have a sweet spot, et cetera? The third thing I ask is, do you have any percentage ownership requirements? Do you have any check size requirements? Like, I want to understand all that stuff up front. And the last piece that I'll always ask is, what's your decision-making process? And can you move quickly? When you ask those set of questions, what you're doing is you're setting expectations up front that you're not going to waste your time. You're busy. You got a lot going on. As a founder, your time is the most precious thing. That you're not, like, it kind of changes the dynamic where it's not just about, I'll take a meeting because you want me to take a meeting. It's, I'm going to make sure this makes sense to even spend the time together. And then you've gotten that stuff out of the way. You've saved a lot of time just from that and from some people that might just be information gathering and wanting to see what are other people doing in the space, filter out the people who are not serious about investing in you. And then you have a conversation where you're really pitching your vision, who you are, and really getting a feel for whether this is someone you'd be open to partnering with. And then you sort of set a time frame on all of that. So I'm getting kind of tactical, but I think it's important to give some more tactical pieces of advice, because I feel like this is the type of stuff that I wish I knew when I'd started. Maybe it would have saved me some time that I learned from other founders that were farther along than I was.
It's excellent. No, it's the stuff I love. Let's get tactical a little bit more. Like, when you're raising that seed round, you had a pretty healthy number of investors. How many did you talk to? What'd your funnel look like during that process, maybe for that first round, if you remember?
It took me a while to learn the part that I just spoke of, which is, like, I don't need to meet with that many investors. I probably spoke to, I mean, still have my spreadsheet. Probably I had a spreadsheet of like 60 investors. I think I only spoke to about 25. Yeah.
Interesting.
I mean, it's always the hardest to sort of get the first set of checks. And I think part of it is, like, the expectations that you set. So if you say, look, I'm just raising 500K. I'm just raising a friends and family, like, seed round. And I have 50% of that I already got committed, and maybe I have room for, maybe I could carve out some room, but I have all these people that are interested, right? So it's like part of it is playing the game of sort of, you have a lot that's going on. The perception aspect of things is very, very important, and kind of raising the first 500 before you say you're raising the next 2 million. So it's kind of saying, I'm just raising a little bit, and here's why, here's my vision, and it's kind of like dating, like, maybe we could go out, but, like, I got all these other people that are interested. Yeah. So, you know, you really got to prove to me, you know, in the right time frame that this is going
to
work.
I'm really feeling like I got to hustle now. To, like,
exactly. You know, that's part of it, right? You got to be the hot deal. And then from there, it's, okay, I close 500. Okay, the next million's a lot easier. Once you get the first 500, that'll lead to the next million. That'll lead to the next 2 million. So I actually was in this situation with NEA. I was only raising 500K. I had Mark. I had few other of my early checks, and I literally was accepting my final check for the small round. I was getting friends and family, people investing in Fallon, and then I got introduced to a partner at NEA, and I remember it was a Friday at 5 p.m., and he came in, and, you know, I was like, I'm not going to get this guy to invest a Friday at 5 p.m. I mean, it's NEA. They meet with tons of founders, and half of the decisions they make really are based on, like, timing and mood. Really, it is. Sometimes people just have a bad day. And we had a 2-hour conversation. It was great. Just got to know a little bit about him, why he wanted to be an investor, and then told him about my story. And then from there, he said, look, like, are you interested in raising more money? Because I'm interested in, you know, if you want me to be a lead, I'm interested in participating. Like, tell me the price. Tell me how much you want. And just bring in a few other, like, firms into this.
Wow. Cool. I wish it was always that easy, right?
Yeah.
I know you got to get out of here very soon. So maybe one last question. Did you have any concern about, you know, these big firms like NEA? I forget how big their fund is, but it's huge, right? Any concerns about, like, the signaling risk if they write a check on your seed round but don't come in later rounds? Was that?
I'm sorry. Signaling risk is complete bullshit. As a founder, you need capital. You're not going to not take money because you're worried about the next round. Like, come on.
Yeah.
Now, NEA has been great, and they have reinvested every time, and they really back their companies. They're going through some shifts right now that just sort of came out in the press around their strategy, but I think it is important to make sure that the investors that do back you in the early days, that you understand which ones are able to actually continue to capitalize as you go through further rounds. There are certain investors that only do seed and will not support you in the A's or B's because their funds aren't big enough. It's important you understand that dynamic. So then you're clear on who can you count on or go back to if you do need more capital. So I think it's just important to kind of keep those things in mind. Signaling risk, you can't worry about that in early stage.
All right. Where do you go from here? What is Node 2 or 5 years from now? And, like, any call to action for people in the audience? Is it something they can sign up for and play with now? What's your plug?
Yeah. So we have a next generation release coming that will broadly allow businesses outside of enterprise, so actually individuals, so professionals will be able to use Node. Just think if Google and LinkedIn had a baby, that's Node. So you don't need a search box. It understands what you care about, understands what's relevant to your business, and it proactively recommends the people and companies and why you should talk to them and so on. So it allows you to kind of help find, you can put in your best employees and find new potential recruits. Same thing with investors as well. In the future, if we succeed, we are the context awareness layer that is powering personalization in all applications and devices. And
cool.
More on that soon.
All right, let's have a hit round of applause for Fallon. Woo-hoo. Nice job.
Yeah, for
Thank
sure.
Thank you. Okay, so she's got to jet out for a dinner meeting, always hustling. But can we have a welcome for Sam Lesson? All right, welcome.
Nice to see you.
Nice to see you. Have a seat.
Thank you.
So Sam's an interesting one. He's a founder, but he's also a VC. He's playing two roles here. So
why not?
Why not, right? And he's an intern, right? The intern at the information.
I'm an intern for life.
Intern for life. I love it. So let's start with Finn. So what is Finn? Give a little context to the people in the audience.
Sure. So Finn is a hybrid on-demand assistant. It has some parts of it which are driven by AI and machine learning. Then we also, believe it or not, like staff full-time employees, shocker, right? Helping to clear tasks. And our basic thesis is AI is kind of bullshit. Machine learning is super cool. Machine learning is really valuable, but, you know, we're way out over our skis in what people expect an assistant to do. But there's a really fundamental shift going on, which is that all of a sudden, if you go from a world where you have to do a bunch of assistance work yourself, you know, scheduling meetings, buying things, booking things, whatever, or maybe if you can afford it, you have full-time person staffed in your office. We're moving from that kind of world, which is incredibly inefficient, incredibly disorganized, to a world where we can create effectively on-demand knowledge work factories, right? Where tasks come in, buy this, book this, schedule this, find this. We can break them apart. We can run it like a factory line, right? Certain steps, machines are way better than humans at doing. Other steps, humans are way better than machines at doing. We can run it like an actual process. And so we're building, it's ultimately a very tech-enabled service business.
Mm.
But the net of it is you can CC Finn on emails, you can forward requests to it, you can talk to it, you know, like you would Siri or whatever, except for we actually are able to deliver true quality and the trust that an assistant actually drives, which is the actual value. Yeah.
Awesome. Interesting. And how long have you been banging on this? What's the origin story to it?
Yeah. So I was VP of product at Facebook for a long time. I reported to Mark. I had what I probably was the best job in technology, but I wanted to go do another startup, especially because my very good friend, Andrew Cortina, a startup called Venmo, I'd actually been his first investor,
okay.
And he was leaving PayPal, and I was kind of ready to leave Facebook, and we decided that we wanted to do something together. You know, life is short. You don't get to work with your friends that much, you know, once you're an adult. You do in college, but later on, it's like hard to sync up with your friends. And so we kind of, what is a problem we really care about? What is a version of the future we think we can have, you know, uniquely go after and provide? And ideally, what can we do to bet against everyone else? And this kind of became a really obvious thing that we really wanted. Like, I use Finn aggressively. So you see, we're no longer the biggest users by any stretch of the imagination. But in the early days, like, I believe in building products for yourself. and we really wanted this. And so we went out, I guess it was late 2015, and started mucking around and have kind of been figuring out how to do it since then.
Cool. What's the most common activity or task that's handled by...
The most common task is boring, and that's scheduling. The reality is the number of meetings you end up scheduling as a professional can be very, very high. People really miscalculate how incredibly time-consuming and expensive it is. And so then there are all these software solutions that are running around. Like, I was actually backstage dealing with someone sent me a Calendly link. I was like, oh my God,
sure.
I barely want to respond to this. And then you have the pure software solutions, you know, people are pursuing. Yeah. The problem is they don't work well enough. And the whole point of having an assistant is actually for them to know you really well, to know your preferences, to understand all the context in your life. What restaurants do you and don't you want to eat at? Where, what is coffee? How do you want to, like, where do you want to meet? And actually have the trust to get it right every time. So with Finn, you could forward a message to it. It's human in the loop. We have all the context. We were really hard on understanding that context. And you actually can build the confidence that we're actually going to get it right, which is the actual value. So it's more expensive, right, than pure software if you purely think about it as giving it to a piece of software or giving it to Finn. But the difference is, because you can actually trust us to get it done, the net cost in mental attention, in needing to deal with mistakes, et cetera, goes way down, right?
Yeah.
And that's kind of how we see the world.
So be honest, when I was reaching out to you and scheduling you to come here, was I interacting with Finn or a real person?
I have absolutely no idea, yeah. Honestly. I have no idea.
That's fair.
Probably Finn.
Cool. And is this a product for consumers or more for enterprises, businesses? What's the
customer? Yeah, so our background, our history is really a B2C company. Like Cortina and I both have grown up building consumer products. We like building things for ourselves, right? And so on day one, we approached this as a consumer product. And we have thousands of consumers and prosumers, small businesses that are paying us for our service, you know, day in, day out to get things done and help them get more done in their lives. There's no question there's an obvious pull towards enterprise. You know, people spend actually staggering. In the U.S., the assistance market, we're just talking about receptionists and people supporting executives. It's literally $500 billion a year. And the utilization on that is terrible, right? The actual utilization, if you think about like how many hours per day is that person productively able to work? It's very, very low. So we are seeing more and more enterprise inbound interest in what we're doing, and we're interested in it. But I think my experience with founders and starting companies is they're consumer guys who think that acquiring users, they know how to do that, and they think that enterprise stuff is a pain in the ass and is scary. And then there's enterprise people who go to the consumer people like, I know how to get enterprise sales. I have no idea how to do consumer.
Yeah.
We're definitely on the consumer end of that spectrum, so we're learning how to talk to enterprises.
Awesome. Cool stuff. So let's switch gears to your other role at Slow VC. And you're a partner there. So
yep.
You're still actively a partner
yep.
at the fund?
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. So I've been doing angel invest for a long time individually. When I left Facebook, I love investing. I think it's really fun. And I talked to a bunch of the VCs on Sand Hill, increasingly the city, but still kind of on Sand Hill.
Yeah, right.
And I couldn't get there. I mean, I love investing, but I don't believe that VC is the best job in the world. I think it's actually really, it's not my jam, but investing is really fun. And so a bunch of friends and I had always had, for many years, I had a venture, something called Slow Ventures, where we would do our own angel investing, and then we kind of pool together with Slow and do 50K, 100K checks into things we were excited about. Three of us, so Dave Morin, Kevin Collin, and I, after I left Facebook, we decided to raise a more serious fund. So we raised a $65 million fund, and we raised about $140 million more recently. And what that means is that we're now, we still do a lot of seed stage investing, but we'll also do A's, we'll do later stage things opportunistically. And you know, we're playing the big boy game now too. My view, honestly, is one of the things that's really missing, this is changing, but historically, VCs were finance people. They weren't founders, right? And the problem is that finance people aren't that useful to you if you're starting a company, right? They might be useful to LPs, but they're not useful to you. And so, you know, my view on it is that for those people who are able to straddle the universes, and I'm not the only person doing this, operating in the field gives you not only incredible empathy, but a hell of a lot more understanding of what's happening on the ground for investing. And investing, you know, the biggest problem with being a founder is you become so myopic about what you're doing. All you see is your problem everywhere. And it's very hard to see the trends. And so I actually think being able, which again, I've been very lucky in my career. I've worked really hard, but I've also just been really lucky. The fact that I can straddle both of those worlds, I think is a real privilege, but I think it's a really fun and useful one.
Cool. And just to round that out a little bit, what types of deals, what space is Slow investing in? You mentioned Series A, and then what types of categories?
Seed. I mean, look, our background is consumer,
yeah.
right? Of the five general partners at Slow, four of us are ex-Facebook. So that's kind of what we know and where we come up from. you know, we've done more and more consumer packaged products, things like that. We do know something about that. Bluntly, I've done a lot in the crypto space in the last few years, which is crazy and really interesting and really crazy. You know, we're pretty much generalists. We end up, we are deeply partnered with a lot of the Sandhill Farm Road firms. And so there's a lot of times we'll do things with them, or a lot of times we'll do a deal and then work with them on kind of putting together the A and things like that.
Cool. All right. So Finn, your startup, if my numbers are right, raised $31 million from Slow VC. So I'm picturing standing in front of a mirror, pitching yourself.
No.
How does this work?
Well, I'm actually really interested in how you derived that number because we've never talked about how much money
this is from PitchBook.
No, actually, so Slow is an investor in Finn, a small investor in Finn. You know, our primary venture capitalists are John Doerr from Kleiner, Samir Gandhi from Accel, and then Sargur from Charles River Ventures. Those are the guys who kind of have priced and done our financing. Slow is a participant, but I think pricing your own deals is a little bit cute, at least, you know, directly. And that's also, you know, Slow's not writing $30 million checks or $50 million checks or $10 million checks, or whatever the number might be, because we haven't disclosed it.
Okay. That's fine. We'll just call it a number. So talk about raising money. Was it, you obviously had sort of an inside track being in the venture world already, but was that make it an easy round to raise, or did you know?
So I've raised money before. So I had a startup called Dropio in, you know, a long time ago. We started in 2007. That was a file sharing platform we sold to Facebook. And we had raised money from back in the day. This is really pre-YC even being a thing. We were a bunch of kids at consulting jobs and we were like, this is terrible. What's the opposite of this? And we went, you know, to Brooklyn and started a file sharing company. And, you know, we were able to raise money from RRE Ventures back then and DFJ's Gotham affiliate, because they had their New York system going. So I've done it a few different times now in different contexts. I think it really just comes down to authenticity. As someone who gets pitched a fair amount and also who has done a fair amount of pitching, no one wants to be pitched, right, is the reality. Like, in the more cookie cutter you come in and do the same thing over and over, you don't want to be obnoxious, right? Like, there's a level of professionalism that I've seen people skirt on the other end where they're like so non-pitchy, or you're just like, this is not even professional. But I just think, you know, people will tell you like there's a way to raise money and like you do this and then you do this and there's the program. And the reality is like in the end of the day, people are trusting you to work on something. They want to get to know you from scratch. It's like, how do you build a relationship? And then how do you tell a story? And how are you authentic to what you're actually doing? You know, for Finn, when we were raising money, we intentionally did not make a deck because we didn't want to. And like, we thought we could tell the story without one. And like, the idea of a PowerPoint, which we hate, was just like, we're like, look, we're happy to walk you through the story, but you know, we're not going to like just put together a bunch of slides that no one wants to read. Right. And so I don't know. I think like, look, again, I'm the first to admit that I've been very, very lucky. And so I've had, you know, Sargur, who, you know, is one of our investors, I've known him for 10 plus years, right? And so a long-term relationship to have built. It's not like I'm trying to raise a flash round in a weekend from people I don't know. I think that's extremely difficult. It's kind of like you ever go to these like founder meetups where they're like, meet your co-founder in a weekend. You're like, that is crazy, right? Like, maybe it works every once in a while, but like, you're going to business with this person long-term. You just like in speed dating style. It's the same thing with investors. I mean, the better you can build long-term relationships with them, help them, go back and forth with them. They're just people and they just want to hear an authentic story and bet on people they believe in.
Yeah. Right? Yeah, no, it's good. Comes down to authenticity, building a relationship, telling a story. So were you just going in with a product demo and your resume or background? Like, hey, look, I mean, VP product at Facebook is going to open a lot of doors, right?
Yes, I think
is that kind of the pitch though? Like, here's who I am and here's
the vision. I think the pitch is like, why are, like, I always like to give is like, why are you doing this? Like, building companies sucks, right? Like, you guys must all know this, like, firsthand, or a lot of you do. It's not easy. It's painful. It's manic depressive. It's like, there's a reason why I would argue the average founder, there's like something wrong with them, right? Because like, it's not a normal or good thing to do from like a health perspective, right? And so then the question is, well, like, why are you doing this thing, right? And I think being able to authentically answer that question is, I think, really, really important. So Cortina and I have our own version of why we're doing this, right? Like, why we left really, really good jobs and incredible places and intellectually stimulated places to do another startup, knowing full well, having done them before, how painful they are. But that's the question I think you just need to be able to answer for yourself and forever you're asking for money is like, why on earth are you doing this? And I don't know. I think if you can answer that really well in a good market, with credibility that you actually can pull it off, which doesn't mean you know all the answers, right? Any founder comes in and pretends to know all the answers, you're just like, you don't get it, right? Like, you mostly don't know what you're talking about. And like, there's a way to be authentic about that and say like, this is what I know, this is why I'm doing this, right? Like, if this was already done, the valuation would be a hell of a lot higher, right? So like, right, that's all, yeah. Like, we can do this together or not. And just remember that, you know, investors are taking way less risk than you are, right? Investing as a venture capitalist, you know, it's like, this is your entire like reputation and life you're pouring into this and like all of your time. And for a VC, it's like, look, if it goes well, they look like a genius. And if it doesn't, well, startups are hard, you know? And like, I think you have to keep that mentality yeah. in mind.
If it doesn't go well, they take the logo off the website. And
yeah, look, they've you know got yeah. liquidation preference, and they'll find a way to tuck it in. And it's your entire livelihood, but they'll get their money back because, you know, they're finance guys.
Yeah, awesome. So, okay, can you stick around for a little bit more?
Sure.
Okay. All right, so next up is Ben of Greenbits. Come on up. Welcome, welcome.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you, sir. So we're just getting all over How's the place going? Today. So Ben's a... on a second startup, right? Or more than that?
Yeah, a second startup that's like actually a product company. I've done a lot of service businesses before.
Okay. So Greenbits, yep. Tell us, what is Greenbits? Why'd you start this business?
Yeah, so I've worked a lot with small businesses building software solutions. Like, I was a QuickBooks engineer, payroll engineer. So I spent a lot of time on accounting and payroll type software as compliance. In 2014, I noticed that states like Colorado and Washington were legalizing cannabis. Some of the interesting things that I saw was them being very, very particular and strict on compliance in particular, on the way they track inventory. This is an area I happen to know a lot about. So I literally flew up to a conference. I spent like 3 days with like about 125 people from the industry. And literally when I left, I was like, man, it's a bunch of small business owners. The government is like putting all these rules on them. There is no software that works for the industry. And I believe the industry was going to grow. And I had a perfect skill set. So to me, I looked at lots of different ideas at the time, and this one really stood out. So I immediately came back, built like a one-page flyer, literally a piece of paper with the value prop. I stole like from Shopify a image of their point of sale, and I changed the logo on it. I sent it to about 100.
Edit that part out. No,
they know they actually sent us something. So I sent it out to about 100 license holders, dispensaries in Washington. Literally got calls from them and sold software before we built it. So that kind of started things, right? I was like, man, if I can sell something in, of this idea that we have before we've even built anything, then I put a little bit more money in and just kind of kept doing that until now we run like almost 1,500 dispensaries, process about $2.5 billion a year goes to our point of sale, the largest in the industry.
Amazing. Yeah.
That's a lot of money per dispensary.
Yeah. So our dispensaries do about $300K on average a month.
Wow. Wow. And this market is just growing, no pun intended. Like, it's amazing.
It's full of puns, by the way. Like, yeah, so try, don't even puns. Try and you will hit, like, a lot of them.
Really interesting. So, okay, very fascinating. Let's talk about raising money. My notes from PitchBook, which may or may not be correct, $17 million from Tiger Global, and then the one I really want to understand is Casa Verde, who's Snoop Dogg's venture arm. I really want to hear about raising money from – did you pitch Snoop Dogg?
Yeah. No. No, so he's got people managing, you know, it's like anywhere else, right? They've got people managing the money. I haven't met him yet. The day's coming soon. So really, like, this is a really unique industry to raise capital because there's, like, investors are investing other people's money, right? So they're going to LPs, you know, they might go to Stanford, Harvard, really wealthy people, right? They're going to get money. When they get money from those limited partners, they attach some sort, they usually like attach something like, here's how you can invest this capital. There's a lot of constraints on traditional VCs on being able to invest in this industry because of that. Like, easy way to call it, like a sin clause essentially in there. And so a lot of people, like, I've raised money from Sequoia, can't, for example, like, invest into this industry.
Even though you're doing software, you're not touching the plant, you're not, I mean,
yeah, you'd even be surprised.
That's forbidden.
Yeah.
We're heavily invested in all the things those guys can't do because we're good at negotiating with our LPs.
There you go.
Yeah. And you'll see. So, you know, when running a normal, like normally raising money and running that process, it takes, like at this pace, you just have a supply issue, really. Like, there's less capital that you can go to. There's like family offices that you can go to. So, like, Tiger Global is kind of in a unique position to kind of act like a VC on their private equity side of things.
What is Tiger Global? I'm not sure. I'm not familiar with
them. Yeah, so they have $12.5 billion hedge fund, okay. A $2.5 billion private equity fund. This year, I think, alone have almost already invested $1 billion. Like, they deploy a lot of capital. They, like, did Wealthfront. They were in, like, Fisher. Sure. So, like, they're tech.
But they did Flipkart. So they got that few billion back this year.
Yes, that's right. Yeah, oh, wow. The Flipkart, they put a – yeah. But they're not like a traditional private equity. Like, they have a lot more control over like how they invest, mm-hmm. and they do lots of deals. Like, that $2.5 billion fund is ran really by one partner and then has like four associates, and they do all of those deals. Like, they're a machine. They do deals very quickly. They're very good at it.
That's amazing. So let's talk about this. So you're raising money in a market that's booming, yet many investors can't touch it. Like, how was the process? Like, how did you identify those family offices that do invest in this? Like, how do you build the target list of investors for this space?
Yeah, so I had a previous startup, and so I've raised, we raised the seed round. It was like Shasta and Ben Horowitz and Mark Andreessen before they had Andreessen Horowitz, and then I had first round capital, and then we did our Series A with Sequoia. Literally, like, a lot of it, I always keep in touch with them, and most VCs will talk to you all the time because, like, they don't know if I'm ever come up with a good idea, right? So they kind of went, so I can, like, go there and show different ideas and get their feedback, and then also say, oh, you can't do this. Well, do you know anyone? So I just, like, kind of work a bit through their networks.
Mm-hmm.
Once you start going out, like, maybe now if you're just starting to raise money, it seems like, wow, there are so many people. In reality, it's pretty small, tight-knit group. So, like, you start pitching, you go out and start talking to people. Like, word gets out. People will reach out to you. Like, that tends to what happen. So yeah, in this case, we actually got the intro from Tiger Global from Casa Verde, actually.
Okay. And how'd you meet Casa Verde?
So Casa Verde is because they target the cannabis industry. There's actually a lot of funds that target the cannabis industry. To me at the time were kind of like, they had the best fund. So when we were raised at convertible debt before the Series A, we raised $2 million in convertible debt. And Casa Verde, that's when we actually got Casa Verde. And then they helped with the introduction to Tiger Global, someone that they talked to on the side and was talking about the cannabis industry. Yeah. And you see, like, VCs tend to go through these, like, they'll go through and do like an investment thesis. So, like, a lot of VCs right now that I talk to are actually like putting together investment thesis on cannabis, and they come up with a kind of an opinion, and then they start playing, oh, okay, who in this industry do you want to invest in? So Tiger Global happened to be doing that around the time. So it was like, it happened to be pretty good timing.
Very interesting. Cool. So your previous company, All-Star Names, Andreessen, what was it like pitching Mark Andreessen, Ben Horowitz back in kind of early days, I guess you could say?
Yeah, so honestly, it was like kind of a smaller check for them. So it was a quick, mainly they followed the, we had like first round in Shasta, so they were kind of like follow-ons on that.
Oh,
so it wasn't too much. We did pitch them on our Series B when we were raising a Series B. That was more intense. Like, that was Andreessen Horowitz at that point. So it was like the partner group. That's intense. I think Sequoia is the most intense, though, because that one is like, there's a lot of partners, and I've never pitched something that large where it's like you're pitching, and like, I'm telling you, like 30 people probably came in and out of the room during the pitch, all holding like packets like this thick about you and your company. It's like really quite intimidating.
That's part of their like theater, though.
Yeah. Oh, dude. Yeah. It was intense, but they're like super sharp. And to me, I don't mind being like my personal, I like to be challenged on things. It helps. I think that's like how you get really good at things, right? So like, it doesn't bother me, but it's definitely intense. Luckily, it's like your business, though. Like, at the end of the day, that's how I think about it. It's like, you're going into to pitch VCs. Well, it's your business. Like, I know everything about the business. I know everything about the market. Like, that's, well, everything that possible to know at the given time, right? So to me, it's more like educating someone else about what you're doing. Everything I do, I'm really passionate. Why the hell would I be doing this if I'm not passionate about it? So mostly, to me, it's like, you've got to believe in that your business is amazing. Don't get blinded by your emotions, though, right? Look at data, look at what's happening, and have conviction. And if you find the right investor, it's a good match. Like, it happens very quickly and naturally, honestly. At least that's what it has been for me so far.
Any differences in raising? What was the original business that you raised money from? What was that one?
It was called Outright. And so what that was is kind of like an easy way. A lot of people know Mint.com. That's like for personal finances. Outright was like similar to that, but for small businesses. We targeted highly like e-commerce. So if you sold on eBay, if you sold on Amazon, we'd suck in all of your revenue data, all your expense data. And what we'd be able to do is pretty much tell you, hey, this is what you owe for taxes. Here's where your best customers are, things like that. Just automate all the back end. pieces. I started in like 2008.
Okay.
And so we raised money.
Tough year to be
raising
money.
Yeah, the worst time ever. I think we closed our seed in November 2018.
Wow.
Sorry, 2008. Thank you. Sorry.
It's a long
yeah. November 2008. And that was like the worst time ever, really, to be.
Surprised you got a deal done. Did you have people drop out? Like, I mean, because that was right when shit was hitting the fan, right? Like, that's.
Yeah, I mean. Most of the companies I have, like, I always kind of bootstrap first. So it's like I'm not going in with some random idea. Like, that was actually, I had a consulting company.
Okay.
And so during that consulting company, we need two things. Like, in 2005, I moved from a PC to a Mac. And I ran all my previous businesses on QuickBooks desktop. And the problem is that QuickBooks on Mac really sucked.
Mm.
And so then I was like, that's no big deal. I'll use QuickBooks Online. Well, the problem is with QuickBooks Online, it only worked on IE6 at the time. So there was like no way to actually, so I had to like dual boot. And that drove me crazy, especially because I could write accounting software. So I said, screw that. I'm going to actually write some stuff to manage all of our contracts. We eventually gave that out to friends and family, and that grew to around 10,000 people using that.
Oh, wow.
And then we started saying, hey, if it's online, then we can connect it to the data sources directly. Like, it starts to feel really dumb if you're like, I'm going to download a bank statement, and then I'm going to like take it, parse it, and then upload it. It's like, well, why can't I just connect it to the bank? And so that's why we eventually aggregated from 12,000 accounts. And then we really learned. Once it's in people's hands, to me, that's when software becomes real. You can have all these ideas and pictures and all that stuff, but once it's in someone's hands and you watch them use it and you see delight, like that's what you're going for. And so that's what we just kept pivoting until we found like, oh, there's this e-commerce niche. And e-commerce at that time was growing significantly. A lot of people in 2008 who lost their job actually went over and kind of became self-employed and started e-commerce businesses and Etsy. So we became like eBay's, one of their largest partners when they built the eBay App Store. PayPal, we were their largest data aggregator. Like we pulled in about 450,000 accounts from them.
Wow.
So like it was, you know, so that was a different story because when we went to get the seed round, I was like, oh, we've got, you know, 10,000 people using it. Here's what they're doing. Here's like, you know, you show real data rather than just like, oh, let me paint a picture of what could be kind of thing.
Huh. Interesting. Cool. We want to keep an eye on the clock. Is Johnny here yet? Yes. Perfect. Okay. If we have a round of applause for Ben, and we're going to scoot you down one more. And then please welcome Johnny Wrench of Quill. How are you, buddy?
That was good.
Good to see you.
Good to see you, Nathan. What's up, guys?
All right. So, Johnny, actually, so this is a real podcast we do. Here's a little plug called How I Raised It. And we've done about 46 of them. And they're just like super real stories about people who raise money. And Johnny did a great one maybe a month ago or so, plus or minus. So look up that on iTunes or SoundCloud. It's really fun. So you're going to repeat yourself a little bit tonight, but tell us what is Quill and where did you come up with the idea for this business? What do you guys do?
Sure. Thank you. Yeah, so I used to be an M&A lawyer, which was terrible. I hope nobody's an M&A lawyer in the audience. But when I left, I joined a Bitcoin startup, which is actually in your portfolio, Zappo.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Good company.
Yeah. I'm an investor, too.
Awesome.
I took a big pay cut, about 70% or more. And so I was freelancing on the side to be able to live the startup dream, so to speak. And during 1 month, I had a contract that just didn't come through. And they didn't pay me on time. So I very nearly defaulted on my mortgage. And I remember this, like, it was such a weird feeling because the bank that wouldn't give me a credit line against that contract, which was, you know, a high credit contract, it was $5,000. It was the same bank that I'd been with since I was an M&A lawyer back in the day. Like, super high credit, like, never missed a bill, et cetera, et cetera. Like, come on, help me out.
Mm-hmm.
And they couldn't. And so I was absolutely trapped. And they actually gave me the advice of, like, go try a payday loan for 300% annualized. And yeah, it was just like, why? Why does this happen?
Sure.
So I realized that this whole subset of the workforce, which is a massive piece of it and it's growing, that just doesn't have access to financial services. So what Quill does is we provide freelancers with access to financial services. The first product that we released, which is our flagship product today and our most popular product, in that same scenario, I would just go to Quill and I would get a cash advance on that, $5,000 almost instantly.
Mm-hmm. Cool. I love that. Everyone tonight basically built products for themselves, right? I mean, it's a great theme here. You know, you're like, I had a problem and I solved it and turned it into a business. That's cool.
Yeah. I mean, I think that like going through like a viscerally painful, helpless experience like that kind of drives you, like going to the point of like, what's going to keep you going when things go wrong or inevitably like it's not up and to the right all the time. I get a little bit of catharsis every time I see, you know, an advance that goes through the system, because I know that somebody isn't going through that fear that I felt when I had that happen to me.
Very cool. When did you start this? How long have you guys been at it?
I left Zappo 3 years ago almost. It was like the end of June 3 years ago.
Okay.
And then I was by myself for about 6 months. Two co-founders joined, and then off to the races, we went live about 2 years ago.
2 years ago.
Yeah.
And then you went into 500 startups, right? So you went to Accelerator.
We did.
Mm-hmm.
We did.
Was that worth it?
Yeah, no, actually, so I'll actually be very enthusiastic about it. So I didn't think that accelerators were a good idea. I was early 30s. I had been an M&A lawyer and managed very, very large, complex transactions, and was kind of like, why do I need to go to an accelerator?
Right.
But then I met Shiel Manot over at 500, and he runs their fintech accelerator and their fintech fund. And within their, actually, he and I talked for the first time the Friday before the next batch was going to start on a Monday. And he was like, so do you want to join? And I was like, well, I don't know. I don't know if I want to give away like a pretty big chunk of the company for something that I don't think I need. And so he's like, whatever, just meet me for brunch on Sunday. And so we went, we had breakfast in Hayes Valley. And within, I think like 10 minutes or so, he was like, look, I know you don't believe in this. I know you don't think you need an accelerator, but I'll solve two problems for you if you come to 500. And one was debt financing, which our business requires a ton of it, and regulatory. And I was like, look, you just pulled the two number one or the top two concerns off of my head without even me prompting you to do it. And so it's like, cool, I'm in.
Cool.
Yeah.
Great. And then fast forwarding, you recently raised a $107 million venture capital and debt round.
Mm-hmm.
So most of that was the debt line, which you're using to make these loans, right?
Correct.
Maybe talk about that. I guess part, maybe both of it. Like talk about raising that venture round, and then also, you know, we haven't talked on raising debt, which I think is kind of interesting.
Sure.
Maybe cover that. How'd you do it?
Yeah, I mean, we run a pretty complicated, both from a business model standpoint and just a regulation standpoint business. We touch all aspects of moving money to lending money. And so it requires both significant operational expense, but the lifeblood of our company is really having debt capital.
Mm.
We're very much inhibited in our growth if we can't advance money to freelancers.
Yeah.
So on that basis, we raised a total of $5 million in operational capital in our A, and then $102 million in debt capital.
Gotcha. And that will let you make $102 million in loans, or I guess you're getting paid back, you're getting principal and interest back. So does that, the snowball that gathers the mass down the hill?
Pretty much. Uh-huh. And the growth rate so far has been a little over 1,000% growth year over year. And
in
so like
customers or loans or
in advance volume.
Okay.
And so I'm basically trying to keep about 10x capacity at any time of debt to advance volume going through the system. And I mean, anyone wants to do numbers on the back of the envelope, I'm out raising debt again.
All right.
I well, constantly.
We're in NASDAQ. I wonder, is there anyone from NASDAQ here?
Yeah, who's got an institutional fund?
Very interesting. Okay, cool. So just doing what you're doing, any kind of tips for the audience in raising money for a company that also requires this big debt line? How do you raise debt? Are the players the same as venture world? Or, I mean, it's a different universe, right?
Well, it depends, because fintech investors may be slightly different from consumer investors, and it's potentially a different type of ethos, although I've seen a lot of crossover with crypto, as that's picked up some speed. In general, like, I'm an ex-lawyer, and I get along famously with credit folks, so I don't know if that's just a fit thing, but the pitch for the debt is very much driven by different things. It's not necessarily a growth story so much as a concentration and management of risk story.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where if you have, like when we raised our first round of debt with a hedge fund, we had no data on defaults. And so we paid an arm and a leg for that money.
Mm.
And then as soon as like some defaults come in, which that's counterintuitive, it's like, no, we run this great product and this great underwriting style that makes it so that we don't lose money. But no, that's not the point. It's we want you to know when you're going to lose money and how to manage that risk.
Mm-hmm.
And then on the venture side, that story is just very much about, can you capture this category? Is the opportunity as good as you think it is, Johnny? We know you think it is, but convince us. And then how are you going to navigate all these sort of regulatory pieces that are going to come and hit you along the way?
Mm-hmm.
So they are very different beasts for sure.
Interesting. Cool. Good. All right. Can we have a round of applause?
Yeah, no, let's give it a round.